Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
May 9th, 2013, episode number 40, The Swarm Storm. Welcome, everyone. This is Kevin England with a new edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Thanks for listening in. It's been a quiet and unsettled spring for beekeeping around our apiary, but things are in full gear here at the BK Corner, and there's so much to bring you up to speed on. Our feature this go-round is centered on swarm management. We'll deep dive in the ins and outs of swarming triggers, indicators, and preventative techniques, along with other useful facts and insights. Then we'll bridge over to some basic techniques on how to perform springtime splits. Our last feature of the episode will be the introduction of the New Jersey Swarm Report, and we'll close out with a run of round-type old topics to finish off the episode. First things first, let's jump right in with the local hive report. We have three hives on the property coming out of February. The good news was all three hives survived the winter. The bad news is two of them were in pretty bad shape. If you've listened to the podcast, you know that we were doing an experiment without feeding the bees in the fall season and to see how they came out in the spring. The information gleaned is that hive number one and number three coming out of fall did not have proper stores and did not have proper amount of bees to ramp up for spring. In fact, the queens were so decimated that they both shut down with very small brood patterns, and fact of the matter is we couldn't find queens operating in those hives. Have to take pause and wonder if it was still too cold for those queens to come out and get things going. We've had an unseasonably cool spring, especially compared to last year here in New Jersey. We've had some 60 and 70 degree days, a couple stretches of them, but it's been cool at night down into the 40s and even down to the 30s at some nights. The normal high for the beginning of May is about 71 degrees here in New Jersey. It's been averaging low to mid 60s, and it's been cool nights for sure. So hive number one was pretty much decimated. There wasn't enough bees in there to sustain and make a colony. Hive number three was also down and appeared to be queenless. We took the opportunity to put the two hives together and cluster all the bees. And then through the mentoring hives, we were able to secure a queen and put it in there. And we'll look to see whether that colony can recover or whether we should go a different route with it. So hive one and three are combined, and now we have two hives on the property. Didn't mention hive number two. That one also overwintered without being fed. The good news is that hive has come out gangbusters and is starting to grow in leaps and bounds. Like a normal spring cluster, it is full. We put a deep on top of it, and it is now running in a three deep configuration. It had been growing, and we've been weighing this hive 1 to 2 pounds a week. This past week, it put on 8 pounds. So the nectar flow has come to New Jersey. And the queen has prolific brood patterns, and this hive is going to be a good producer for the season. The bad news is, it is likely that I am going to have to use this hive to split and split and split to grow the apiary. My hope, my want, my desire is to use all the equipment sitting in the garage and grow to 7 to 9 hives. Whether you could split one hive into that many by the end of a season is a good question. I've heard Michael Palmer, who is famous for that type of discussion, say that's completely feasible if you start with a good nectar flow, which is what we're in here now. We'll be keeping an eye on that hive to see whether or not we're going to see some capped queen cells and whether we have opportunities to do splits. Also be looking for other opportunities to secure bees through the season, and we'll get the apiary up and running. Probably by midsummer, we'll have a number of hives. I'm quite interested to put a couple new configurations for our hive environment into place. I've talked about this on past episodes. We just put the finishing touches on a top bar hive that we're ready to put into service. I have a brand new cedar hive that we won in a contest and can put that into service. And also have put together a configuration to build a hive not out of deep boxes, but a bunch of mediums stacked. The downside that people talk about is the number of frames in there, but easier to work, lighter, and also very interchangeable depending on what you want to do. So I have a bunch of these ideas to work through the system. All I need is a number of bees. Local hive report, hive one and three got combined. We now have one hive there, and hive number two is really good. We have two hives on the property, and we're in spring, so we'll get to that recovery and get things going. The net on the experiment to close that out, and if you're not sure what I'm talking about, I mentioned it in the number of episodes, so this is the last time I'll bring it through. We tried to see whether or not the bees would survive the winter without being fed excess stores of honey and or pollen supplements in the fall. The answer is yes, they did survive, but they're a little bruised and battered for it, and it probably wasn't the best scenario. I guess the takeaway for me is that come fall, I will make sure that they have some stores. But I did learn, or do believe, that the 60 to 80 pounds in full huge stores of honey, I just can't see that as being relevant. My expectation is that we'll build out some honey stores through the seasons, either the spring or the fall. If we have a good fall nectar flow, we'll set it aside, and we'll make sure that they have some honey stores going back into fall, and we will feed them some if need be, but not going to do an excess amount of storage for them, because the last three or four beekeeping seasons, they've come out of spring with far more stores than they need. And while the experiment didn't go well from the state of where our bees are, I think it was a lesson learned that we can apply to the fall season when we talk about getting our bees ready to overwinter. So that's it for our local hive report. We'll keep an eye on them and keep things going for the 2013 summer season, which is just around the corner. For our feature for this episode, we're going to talk about swarm management. If you've ever had the pleasure of standing in and amongst thousands of bees flying away in a storm, it is a wonder to behold, and for a beekeeper, something that becomes a lifetime experience. That being said, a responsible beekeeper would probably wish to abate any swarms and keep the bees in the box and keep the workforce that they've strived so hard to manage. If a responsible beekeeper thinks about this, the best type of swarm is the artificial kind, the one that you create by doing splits or managing your colonies and not allowing half of your workforce to fly away. Now, some people will say, well, that's the way of the bees. For 300 million years, they fly away to create a new subspecies. But in the case of a responsible beekeeper, it could mean a result that you're holding colonies in your local neighborhood and they're hanging off your neighbor's mailbox or their eaves or possibly making residence in their barn. In this feature, we're going to talk about why bees swarm, the type of swarms, and the timing that comes along with swarming for the season. We'll discuss the sequence of events that leads up to a swarm, the triggers and indicators that you can look for to know whether swarming is right around the corner, and then topics about how to prevent a swarm altogether. We'll finish up with a couple odds and ends about swarming, and then we'll go into splits for our second feature, which will give you some more insights on how to take care of that artificial swarm part that we talked about. So let's start off with why swarming? Well, it's the natural and instinctive behavior of honeybees to reproduce. If you think about how a honeybee colony operates, they create more bees in two ways. The creation of the individual bee within the confines of the colony, and the swarming of a subset of the population to create a new colony. Creation of a new bee inside of a colony keeps the colony operational and it keeps the business running, but even the best colonies cannot sustain forever without issuing swarms. Swarming reproduction has taken place for millions of years and is the de facto method for propagation of the species and assuring genetic diversity. Now, before we get into all the different aspects of swarming, let me just introduce swarming types. Some might debate about these classifications, but for the purpose of discussion, I'm going to claim four swarm types here that I'll discuss. Reproduction swarms. As I just said, the natural and instinctive behavior of the honeybee colony to reproduce. Absconding swarms. Something often does not suit the colony and the colony leaves. After swarms. After the initial swarm leaves, the hive still has swarming pressure, so it issues more swarms. And late season swarms. For some reason, a subset of the colony decides to leave to reestablish a home. A late season swarm is often futile for bees, and that swarm is not likely to survive. And time has not provided any insights on why this happened, and no good answer for the purpose, but there is a difference here that the late season swarm is a little bit different than the true reproductive swarm. So swarm timing is one of the first topics, and the timing varies by locale. It varies on other factors: location and elevation, temperature and recent weather conditions, abundance of viable forage, and more. Oftentimes, the swarm season has indicators. For example, one can surmise that swarm season will kick in approximately 20 to 30 days following the first dandelion blooms or forsythia flowers or whatever you have in your forage space. And swarm timing exhibits traditional patterns. Swarm seasons coincide with the abundance of forage. For the northeast climate, where we're hosted in New Jersey, the typical swarming activities kick off in mid-spring and carry through to late summer or even the first frost. Traditional start dates as a data point, but not a standard. You could watch the patterns from year to year to give you a good perspective. However, weather fluctuations from year to year make setting a defined date, such as swarm season starts May 1st, it's just not an accurate way to do it. And what you have to do is judge what you see leading up to the swarm season. For example, I just mentioned the presence of forsythia and dandelions as an indicator that swarming will soon follow. So that leads into swarming itself and the sequence of events. One could surmise that swarming actually gets its genesis from the fall before the spring nectar flow and comes as a result of abundant stores. If you've been a good beekeeper and you've taken care of your mites in July and August, and you've had a strong colony that had plenty of stores in the fall and it overwintered and it came out with a good start, then you are having a vibrant community which could potentially lead right into swarming. So that's kind of one of those sequence of events that actually starts the season before. For strong hives, most of the time you could say the swarming procedures start when the nectar flows. So the lead into swarming could be a strong fall or a nectar flow, but you have to look for the triggers that drive swarming. So triggers and indicators, the first thing is crowding and resources. Crowding is one of the more likely triggers for swarming. Crowding comes in two forms. The first manifestation is a simple overabundance of bees. The second is a lack of space to work, specifically for the queen to lay eggs or the workers to store incoming resources. So let's talk about some of this crowding stimulus. In the case of abundance of bees, vertical bees in the cells become horizontal bees on the face of the comb upon emerging. If you filled an elevator with people standing up and told them all to lay down horizontally on the floor, they wouldn't fit. Just as you may not like being in a crowded space, bees being shoulder to shoulder get the sense that things are tight, and this spurs a swarming stimulus. resource crowding stimulus. Lack of space to store needed resources, especially when abundant supplies are available, is a stimulus. It could be noted that it's not natural for the bees to swarm during a flow. Their job is they want to bring in as much as available to them at the time it is, and a swarm issued is a disruption to the capability of taking advantage of the bounty of the harvest. Abundant stores without a place to put them could equal to swarming. They need to make room when the time is available. So one of the things that occurs is the backfilling of the brood nest. If there are no cells to store nectar outside of the brood area, bees will use the brood area and the queen will have no place to lay eggs. When there's no place to store, something's got to go. However, it should be noted that sometimes the bees may have ulterior motives. Sometimes it's observed that even if you have proper supers with drawn comb, the bees will fill the brood nest anyway. Perhaps the activity can be explained as they want to shut the queen down. You want to recall that these bees have been outside the hive and they know the conditions. And they have other things to consider. Maybe they know how old the queen is. Maybe they know the quality of the offspring the queen is producing. Maybe they know the ratio of bees being produced, drones to worker bees. Maybe they know the pheromones she is or is not putting off. In essence, the motivation of the colony is complex, and the ecosystem in which the queen doesn't necessarily drive all the decisions. When the queen is not laying, there are no mouths to feed, and the colony suddenly has bees with no brood to look after. The queen, with no eggs to lay, might not be fed, and that begins the process of slimming her down in preparation for swarm issuance. It's all kind of intertangled. Talking about storage space problems, when the bees have flat run out of room in the storage area, they will perceive that a change needs to take place. And a swarm mechanism can kick in if the honey storage area is packed and bees don't have any other place to store resources. The bees see no space as a lack of a future and a waste of potential resources if they can't use what is available to them in nature. Also, if they run out of room, it results in bees have nothing to do. Restlessness from unemployed bees can set in motion a swarm response. Now let's talk about chemical signals of the pheromone kind. Pheromone is the glue that keeps the hive operating. The queen's scent keeps everything together, and the bees in the hive come in contact with the queen and distribute the pheromone throughout the hive. They also exude their own pheromone, which is the glue, as we said, that keeps everything together. The distribution of the queen's pheromone, among other things, demonstrates that she has a presence and inhibits the colony from building queen cells. Sometimes it's an overpopulation factor. The overpopulation of bees changes the fundamental makeup of the chemical signals in the hive. It is possible when there's just too many bees in the hive, the pheromone signals get diluted and it results in a change to swarming behavior. You also have age differentials and less vigorous queens. Older queens don't produce the pheromone in the same way as a young vigorous queen, and it is perceived as an indicator that she's failing. So one could deduce from this that the queen doesn't necessarily decide when to swarm, it's her daughters in the hive that move swarming into action. Another thing that the bees know is that the age of the bees and the population vary, and that may potentially set off some sort of swarming mechanism. What I mean by that is, if most of the colony are foragers and older bees, and there's fewer younger ones, or vice versa, that is, again, a change and a complex in the ecosystem that could potentially lead to swarming. There's one last trigger, which is ventilation. Temperature, and more so ventilation, has been cited as a possible reason for swarming. Bees are insects, and people are people. But to illustrate a point, think about it when you jam a lot of people in a small space. It gets uncomfortable, heat builds up, and it starts to feel crowded. Like us, bees need to maintain a certain temperature inside the colony, and if the conditions are not right, they may be forced to use swarming as a means of putting things right. So now you have all of these indicators that could potentially be clues to you as to why a swarm would occur, or the triggers that could do it. Let's talk about the indicators. So let's start with the queen herself. Queen cell indicators. When you see queen cups with royal jelly, you may have an indicator that a swarm is present. In fact, you have a very strong indicator. Hold on a minute. That's a Kevin moment in the making there. That sounded a little bit like Jeff Foxworthy. When you have a queen. All right, stop, Kevin. Every once in a while, I can't stop my mind from doing these type of things. You know what I'm saying? Now, where was I? Oh, yes, queen cups with royal jelly. Yep, that's a pretty good indicator that you're going to get a swarm. If they're building queens, a swarm is a promissory note that is going to happen. The mere presence of queen cups, however, is not an indicator. In fact, the bees like to build them, and they like to tear them down, and they like to have them around, but it does not mean that a swarm is imminent. You're looking for a peanut-shaped cell with a hole, and when you tilt it up and look in the bottom of it, you will or will not see royal jelly and or a larvae inside. And if you see it capped, it means it's capped. So capped queen cells? Yep, an indicator that a queen is being replaced for some reason. It means one of two things. A swarm is about to happen, or something happened to your queen and they're replacing her. So think about the situation at hand. Consider the circumstances in which you are seeing a capped queen cell. If it's late summer, it's been dry for a few weeks, and stores are scarce, but suddenly you have a queen cell, oh, and you can't find the queen in the colony, you likely have a supersedure. If it's just rolling in the spring, stores are abundant, and you suddenly see a capped queen cell in your bustling hive, that's a different message altogether. So the physical queen, as a swarm indicator, the queen provides signs, but this requires an observation level that's probably not practical for most beekeepers. But if you could be observant enough, you might encounter that. The workers feed the queen less. They build out queen cups and she uses them. The queen slims down and is kept from laying an abundance of eggs. These things can be observed by difference in brood pattern. The physical queen age, older queens have a propensity to swarm, and queens raised after the summer solstice are less likely to swarm the following spring. So all of these things about the queen proper give you indicators on whether or not a swarm is possible or impending. Now, we already talked about crowding, so let's talk a little bit more about that. Population crowding indicator. When frame after frame within the colony is covered with brood, you are going to have a huge mass of bees in short order. When every frame is covered with bees, literally, and there is brood underneath them, there's no place for them to go, and swarming will likely result. Resource crowding as an indicator. When you see the stores being placed directly in the brood chamber, you have a strong indicator that the colony does not have enough room and something's going to have to shut the queen down. As an indicator, when frame after frame of honey exists over the brood chamber and there's no room to grow, there's no space to put anything else, chances are that could potentially kick in a swarm. So one more indicator is white wax as an indicator. Let me set this up a second here. Nectar flows are in a way symbiotic with the process for the bees to use and make wax. Wax-producing bees need to be of a certain age, and they need the right resources in the form of nectar and pollen to be able to actually produce wax. It stands to reason, then, that when flows are on, bees can create wax. This becomes an important sign for the probability of bees to swarm. White wax in the hive is indicated of a strong ability to make wax. Ideally, bees would convert that ability to make more comb to store nectar and pollen, which relieves crowding. If they have no space, however, to build new comb and to manage the influx of stores, then the next indicator comes into play. Crowding. When there's no more room for them to build and they're shut in, it is an indicator that they can potentially swarm. So we've gone through the triggers, we've gone through the indicators. Let's step into swarm prevention techniques. Manage space, manage a queen, manage conditions. So first things first, prevention of space issue concepts. Once the mechanism for swarming is kicked off, it's probable that you cannot hold it off by conventional means. So swarm prevention is just that, taking action before the swarm mechanism kicks in. The key to doing this is to understand what has been covered so far and taking action at the right time to head it off. In some instances, your objective is to use the biology of the bees to convince them that the conditions are not optimal for issuing a swarm. So again, what we said, number one, manage a brood area to keep the queen working. Two, fool the workers into thinking they don't have enough stores. And three, manage the ecosystem. That's how you do swarm prevention techniques. So specifics about this, manage space. Brood management. Grow the brood chamber. And we'll use a technique that is widely known called pyramiding up. So a common term for this is pyramiding up. It's often attributed to Dee Lusby, a well-known beekeeper from Tucson, Arizona. And more can be found about this on the web if you're interested. So how does someone do pyramiding up? You add additional hive boxes right above the brood chamber and below the honey dome. You intersperse the brood chamber into a larger space by supplementing fresh drawn-out honeycomb in between drawn frames of brood. Key to this is you do not use foundation. It has to be drawn comb that the queen can lay in. If it's foundation, it's barren land, it serves no purpose. So pyramiding up, you're going to take brood frames. Let's say you have six of them together, brood, 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 brood. Every other brood frame, you're going to move it up into a box, and in between the ones that you've taken out, you're going to put empty, drawn-out, fresh comb in between. The queen will have a cornucopia of space to work in, both in the box that you started with and in the box above it, and the nurse bees will operate in that whole space, and everybody will be happy you have relieved congestion in the brood chamber. The second component of managing space is about resource management. Swarm prevention comes in the form of providing more space to put stores in. It simply means putting drawn foundation in the hive so that bees have more room for pollen, nectar, water, and propolis. There's a technique called checkerboarding that was designed by Walter Wright, who is a beekeeper from Elkton, Tennessee, who figured out that if you provide space in the honey dome, the bees will hold off from swarm preparations. Similar to the technique of providing space in the brood chamber and keeping the queen employed, providing space in the storage area keeps the rest of the colony employed. Provide an extra hive body and intersperse fresh drawn comb between capped honey frames. Do this right over the brood chamber. Do not make the mistake of using frames with plain foundation. It's not going to work. And do this before they start backfilling the brood chamber, or you could be too late. So again, you can put in an extra box. You can take what is a frame of honey, a frame of honey, a frame of honey, a frame of honey, and split those up. Every other frame, take it up and move it to the box above it, or take it out and put fresh comb in it and harvest that. Make more room for them to have more stores of pollen, nectar, propolis, water, whatever they need. There's two methods to prevent swarm through management of space, brood management, and resource area. Now let's go into the second technique, which is manage the queen. So the queen could be considered in many ways the hub of all that goes on within the colony. Queens grow old and they lose their vigor. Signals come in many forms, but two key ones are lower egg production and less pheromone. As a beekeeper, there isn't much to manage here. When you have an old queen, the logical answer is to replace her with a more vigorous one. Ideally, if you want to do this and you want to maintain your own stock, you could take queen cells out of a source hive in your apiary and introduce them, pinch the queen off, and that will be your choice as a replacement. You could take the old queen out and put her aside or pinch her off, but she cannot be in the hive when you introduce a queen cell from another place. Of course, if you're just in the business of pinching off the queen, you can buy a new one that you'll simply introduce. Not a difficult way to prevent swarms, but keeping a fresh queen in the hive is something you can consider as a technique. So one other thing to do from a technique standpoint is manage conditions within the hive. And I want to talk about two aspects of that. The first one is ventilation, and the second one is use of a slatted rack. So ventilation and crowding can play a role in swarm behaviors. We talked about that before. For ventilation, it's simple. Give ventilation at the top of the hive. Don't underestimate a fresh water supply in the ventilation area. When the bees are so crowded that they can't ventilate the hive and they're out bearding on the outside, it is possible that that could lead to swarming. So just give more space. Some beekeepers will tell you go from a 10-frame hive to 9, and that opens those side areas on each side, which helps to ventilate. I don't know whether Langstroth had that in mind, but that is one potential option. The other is use of a slatted rack. This is a technique to provide overcrowded bees with a place to go. The bees can cluster at the bottom of the hive, and in some cases, slatted racks negate the need for the bees to exit the hive when it's too hot and beard on the outside. Some beekeepers swear by this contraption, which you can buy in a bee catalog or make on your own, and others do call them just that, a contraption. So let's talk about a couple other things related to the biology to close out this topic. First one is queen cup timing. It's really probably a good idea for you to know some of the biology on the queen issuance once you discovered capped queen cells in your hive. So the queen replacement timing goes this way. Day number one, the first eggs laid in the queen cup. Day number 8, those eggs are sealed. Day number 16, the first virgin queen emerges. When is it prime swarm time? Between day number 8 and day number 16. On day number 16, one of two behaviors occurs. The virgin queen exits the cell and goes to the other cells to fight or to kill off any potential swarms. Or the worker keeps that virgin queen at bay, and there are subsequent swarms that come from other capped cells in the hive. So, reviewing that, day 1, the egg is laid. Day 8, the egg is sealed. The queen is sealed. Day 16, she emerges. Prime swarm, the first swarm from your hive, typically occurs between day 8 and day 16. So if you see a capped cell, you know that within the next 8 days, you have a high probability, if your hive has swarming conditions, that it's going to take place. Keep that in mind when we talk about the weather factor in a few moments. So one other thing is, when you have day 16 come and the queen goes and kills all the other things, all the other cells, the remaining queen mates then and goes out and comes back, and it could take up to 30 days for her to take place. And if you have a swarm issuance from your hive and the virgin queen has to be mated, one of two things happen. It takes a full 30 days for her to kick in and start laying, or She flies out to get mated and gets eaten by a bird and never comes back, and your queen is hiveless. So this is where I get to what to do and what not to do when queen cells are present. Day 8 through 16 represents the best opportunity for an impending swarm to leave. At this time, one of the ways to prevent a swarm is to perform an artificial swarm or take some other intervention. So you could take those queen cells out of the hive and put them somewhere else, and it may hold off the swarming. But it is not advisable to mash all the queen cells when you see them. So the first thing you have to consider is, how do you know the queen hasn't left and you go around and smash all your queen cells and now your hive is queenless? And the second thing is, whether you smash all those queen cells or not, when a swarm is going to go, it will still issue regardless. So you're really not achieving the objective. And there is advice out there that when you see queen cells, just smash them all. Don't do it. That's our guidance. Do not do it. Now I want to talk about swarm issuance timing. Today is May 11th. It rained in a huge way here in New Jersey today. It's been raining for the last number of days. The spring nectar flow has been on for a month. It is prime swarm season. Tomorrow it's supposed to be sunny and warm. Bees are said to swarm after a storm has passed through. And there's logic to this. When a storm passes through, especially the one of today's size, it scrubs the atmosphere. You've probably observed the clean, crisp, fresh air of the next day when the sky is blue and the stars are wonderful. If your colony is exposed as they leave the hive and become a swarm, and they're moving to a new home, wouldn't they want to do that when the weather is going to be good for a spell? So the pattern's often the same. The bees will be restless during this interval, immediately before the swarm. They'll store enough food for 7 to 10 days, and they'll leave a hive on a sunny day between the hours of 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. right after some storm has moved through. Here's another one for you. What do you do as a homeowner when it rains for a couple days and then the grass is growing? You go out and mow your grass. And people mow their grass between 10 and 4. And lo and behold, you're out mowing the grass in the afternoon after it's rained, and a swarm issues. Is it coincidence? Well, there is one factor to it. It's called vibration. There are some that say the vibration of a mower rolling past a hive generates some sort of angst inside the hive, and swarms issue because of the vibration. It's a reaction. True folklore, don't know, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. So another odd and end, but let me talk about that, right? It does not have to follow a swarm. It can be whatever condition it is. When they're ready to swarm, they're going to swarm. But when you see that weather pattern come, always keep in the back of your mind somewhere that that first nice sunny day between 10 and 4 would be a prime opportunity to see a swarm go away. So now I want to talk about those other types of swarms that I mentioned right at the opening. Secondary swarms, bees have evolved for over 300 million years. Even with all the science, why the hive issues a secondary swarm is unknown. It would be reasonable to think that they would get a secondary swarm out and it would be wasteful, but we don't know why. And there are hives that swarm and swarm and swarm and swarm until there's the hive collapses. Nobody knows why that is that way. It's kind of weird, but it is what it is. So when you get that first swarm issued, do be prepared that it is possible that secondary swarms will issue. Now absconding, this is not really a swarm per se, but the whole hive leaves. It just takes off. It's called absconding, and sometimes it's confused with swarming, but it's a different activity altogether. But because it's a close cousin, I'm going to bring it up here. So why do they abscond? There's a severe dearth or shortage of food for them. They just feel like they have to go someplace else because they're not going to survive in the atmosphere they're in. There are pressures from predators or pests within the hive. Small hive beetles, mites, wax moths, ants, skunks scratching at the hive, or some other predators. There's excessive heat. There's severe overcrowding. And another reason why they abscond is something's wrong inside the hive. Maybe there's something bad in the comb, or there is no comb. All of these things can be reason for absconding. And you typically see that when you capture a swarm, and you think everything's great, when you load them in a box on foundation, and they decide that that's not where they want to be. Or the scouts have already found this optimal location, you put them in the box, and they decide they're still going to go to that other place. So absconding is just not swarming, but a related activity, and it's good to understand some of the reasons why. So we're just about at the end of our swarming feature here, but two or three more little tidbits to give you. A swarm is a swarm. Sometimes you're just not going to stop it no matter what you do. You could curse yourself, or you can embrace a concept and be proactive. Do something in advance, like putting out swarm traps. Sometimes it works. Be ready with equipment for the possibility of a swarm is not a bad strategy. It is always favorable to try and catch your own bees and put them back in a box and keep them in your apiary, especially if you're trying to pay for and maintain hygienic stock and things like that. The other thing is, as you're building space and doing all these techniques that I told you, don't overdo it. Consider the timing and the weather, predators, wax moths, things like that. It's been relatively cold spring here in New Jersey this year. When you start pyramiding up and doing all these things, can the bees keep the colony warm, the cluster warm? If you super up and split the brood too early, you could chill it and the hive goes backwards. Make sure that you have bees enough to protect the hive and keep it in check and support it. If you make so much space and you're using old comb that potentially had brood in it, and all of a sudden you get a wax moth infestation, you're going against yourself here. So always keep in mind your management techniques and whether you're overdoing it. Sometimes more is not better. Now the last thing about swarming is hiving a swarm. That's a whole episode in itself. There's a technique to this, but it's going to be left for another time. So I covered a lot of information, been talking for a long time. Hopefully you found all that useful. But in summation, manage space, manage your queen, manage your colony, and do your splits. Try not to allow swarms to go out if you can, especially if you're in an urban area where it's deemed to be irresponsible to not manage your bees properly. And you have issuance of swarms, which alarms the public and is not good for beekeeping overall. It is probably not a good technique, and I have to say this because I've heard people do that, to wait for the swarms to issue to capture them to reproduce your apiary. It's better to learn the split techniques that are available to you, which we're going to cover in the next segment. So I hope you've enjoyed this. If you have any information about swarms that you want to share back, please feel free to communicate to us. We'll give you our contact information, kevin@bkcorner.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, and our website is www.bkcorner.org. You can also leave us a voicemail at our phone number, 609-460-4037. We'd be happy to hear from you. And if you have any swarm techniques or indicators, things like that, that we've talked about that you want to share with everybody, please feel free to post over at our Facebook page and keep that going, as always interested in hearing what others do to try and prevent swarming and manage it. For segment number two, we're going to talk about a topic close to the swarming mechanism, and that is making colony splits. When you have crowded colonies, one of the ways to relieve the congestion is to break them apart And I want to start by saying this is not an all-encompassing guide. We've covered splits before on the podcast, but it's just kind of a primer to get you through a couple methods. We haven't talked about this in a while, and it is something that I think everybody should understand and know, especially when we talk about sustainability in your own apiary. You want to propagate your own bees. So the concepts of making a split, first it's deconstructing one hive and making two or more out of it. It could also be thought of as redistributing its resources. Some reasons to make splits: to make more colonies, of course, swarm prevention, which is near and dear to this episode, an integrated pest management technique, and as we said before, resource reallocation. One has to make a decision when considering splits. It's honey or more bees, not moths. Splitting hives serves many purposes, but one of them is not to make more honey. Splitting hives is a depletion of stores of a colony with an expectation that both sides of the split will grow and recover. However, I put an asterisk on this, sometimes splits are done to take one resource from a colony and give it to another colony. There you are increasing the workforce, and you're taking forager bees that are not loyal to the queen, harvesting from one hive and giving to another to make a superorganism during a honey flow. So there is one form of split that can get you more honey, but usually it depletes the other hive. So there's many ways to split. I'm going to talk about four of them. And when I talk about this, I want to say that there's so many labels for these things, I can't really find a common lexicon for what you call these things. So I'm going to go very simple in this. I'm going to call them four different ways. One of them is one for you, one for me. Next one is find the queen. A common term for the third type is a walkaway, and the last one is don't find the queen. So either you're comfortable in finding and handling the queen or you're not. Either you're comfortable inserting a new queen into a colony or you're not. Either you're comfortable determining eggs or you're not. And maybe you just can't bring yourself to pinch off a queen. You have to choose the style that fits your level of expertise. So let's talk about the equal distribution split, one for you, one for me. The premise is you're dividing the hive into two. Distribute the resources equally. It requires a working queen with the presence of eggs to work. Do this in the spring with a vibrant colony, and it's likely that you have eggs and can proceed without a lot of wherewithal. Other times, you could split out the hive without eggs, but you'll need to know which one has the queen and put a new queen in the one that doesn't end up with one. So the technique for one for you, one for me, is set two boxes near the origin hive. You really don't have to do this, but for the purpose of illustration, let's just go with that. You could really just use the original and set another box next to it. You'll see in a moment. From the origin hive, take the first frame of honey and put it in box number one. Take the second frame of honey from the origin colony and put it in box number two. Now take the first frame of brood and put it in box one. Second frame of brood from the origin colony, put it in box two. Take the first frame of pollen and put it in box one. Second frame of pollen, put it in box two. Seems pretty simple so far, right? It just keeps going. You continue this distribution until you've divided the hive in half. Now, sometimes the bees aren't that neat and tidy and things aren't split up specifically. Don't fuss over it. Put some brood over here, some brood over here, and that's really kind of the key point. If you could see eggs and larvae, then it's best to split those too. So the final thought is, in this method, the queen is in there somewhere, but it shouldn't matter. As long as you have eggs, whichever box ended up short should create a queen. That hive will be out of operation during the queen raising period. As with many split methods, if you can determine where the queen ended up, you could put a capped queen cell in the other to expedite the process and or insert a queen. Doesn't sound too complicated, does it? And this, for the novice beekeeper, is a pretty simple way to do it. Again, remember, when you do this, method, you are setting the hive back at some point because you're splitting the resources in half. But the one with the queen will recover pretty quickly, especially if there's a nectar flow on. So method number two is a traditional split, and this does require you to follow the queen. You could follow the equal distribution method, one for you, one for me, but explicitly find and manage a queen. Another way you do this is you take one frame of honey, one frame of capped brood, one frame of open brood, but drawn comb, at least one frame of pollen. You want to take a number of nurse bees to care for the brood that you're pulling out, and one frame of open brood, that is eggs and larvae on it. You're going to leave the queen in the original hive, or whatever way you want to do it, if you want to carry the queen over and let her run that nuke. I say nuke because most people do pull these over and put them in a nuke. You can put them in a single box with some other frame. It's really your choice on how you want to proceed. The key to this method is ensuring that whichever box gets the eggs, you leave enough nurse bees that they're going to raise their new queen and be able to take care of the brood wherever it is. So the next method of splitting is very popular, and it has a name that people find very appealing, and it's called the walkaway split. It applies when you have a hive with a large brood area that spans two or more boxes. Each of the boxes is presumed to have enough stores to become its own hive. It must have eggs for this to work. You're not concerned where the queen is. Whichever box doesn't have a queen will raise one. The technique is you would do your inspection, and if you find brood in the top deep and you find brood in the bottom deep, you take one box, you set it on a new bottom board, you put an inner cover over it, an outer cover over it, and you close both the hives and walk away. That's it. That's a walkaway split. The assumption here is the queen's going to be in one side, and the other side is going to have eggs, larvae, nurse, brood, pollen, honey, whatever it requires to operate the other and make itself a queen. Now you understand why people find this so appealing. So on this run through, I have one more to talk to you about. It's called the no queen method. And again, there's names for all these, formal names, but I'm just giving you simple terminology so you can figure out which one is which. The general principle of this is you're taking, again, brood, nurse bees, and you're moving it to a new place. But this is a little bit different of a technique. So you do this in a manner that does not require you to find the queen, guaranteed, but you do need some equipment for this. So how does it work? It's a two-step method that requires you to isolate a part of the hive from the queen for a period before you move it over. Let's go through the technique on this. You spray the bees lightly with sugar water mixture and take the following frames from your mother hive and place them without bees into spare equipment. First frame, a frame with honey or nectar, bees are removed. Shake the bees into the mother hive and flick them off with a bee brush. Place the honey frame on the far side of the box away from you. The second frame you're looking for is a frame of pollen. Again, bees removed, place the pollen frame near the side of the box closest to you. Third frame, a frame of drawn comb or foundation if you don't have drawn comb. Bees removed, place this on the far side of the box inside the honey frame. For the fourth and fifth frame, a frame of open brood, bees removed, placed in the center of the hive. For the sixth and seventh frame, a frame of open and or capped brood, bees removed, placed in the center of the hive. And then you're going to fill in with whatever you have, presumably drawn comb is best. So you combine any original frames not taken to make a split in the center, mostly empty hive body, and place the newly added frames evenly to the outside. So reassemble the mother hive by placing frames of foundation or built-out comb, if you have it preferably, in the vacancy left from the frames you've taken to make the split. Collapse it down into a bottom box. Lightly smoke the bees so they remain stationary in the bottom box. And place a queen excluder over the mother hive. Said another way, you're taking everything that's left in the mother hive, which has the queen in there, and all the bees. You're putting them into the bottom box. You're putting a queen excluder. And then you're taking the box that you've pulled all these frames out, and you're putting it over top of the queen excluder. Place the inner cover and the outer cover on the hive and leave it alone for 24 hours. In the 24 hours, this is what is going to happen. Now you've taken brood and you've moved it up to an empty box. The nurse bees from down below will be loyal to that brood, and they shall come up through the queen excluder and go back to that brood to take care of it. That means the top box, with all the information and stores that you've put in there, will have nurse bees in there, but no queen. That's important. The next day, you're going to take those bees off, and with the brood that you put in there, they will raise a new queen. So here's the technique for that. Take a 5-frame nuke or an empty box out with you in preparation for moving the split to a nuke body. Remove the top cover from the hive and remove the following frames from the top box above the queen excluder into the nuke. First frame, the outer frame of pollen, place it on the far side of the nuke box and take the bees with it. Second frame, the outer frame of honey or nectar, place it on the near side of the nuke box and again take the bees. Third frame, place the inside pollen frame with a frame of drawn comb and take the bees with it. You're following the method here is that you're taking the bees. Fourth frame, fifth frame, brood inside the nuke and brood, open brood inside and take the bees with it. So you're basically taking everything that was in the brood chamber on that top box and you're putting it into a nuke or another deep. You're going to take the remaining bees on the frames that you did not take, and you're going to shake them into the box. The reason you're doing this is you want the extra bees in the nuke to be able to care for all of the brood. So you've removed 5 frames, honey, pollen, open brood, closed brood, and an empty frame, and you've put them in a nuke. That's the right configuration for them to go forward and grow. You've taken all of the bees out of that top box, which are nurse bees and maybe some foragers, and you put them in the nuke. Close up the nuke, set it aside, put it somewhere in your apiary. If there's forager bees in there, they may potentially fly back to the mother home. That's okay, because really what you're after is the nurse bees in there, and that's why you've taken some of those excess. Take any of those frames that were left, and you could do a couple things with them. You can remove the queen excluder and collapse the whole hive back down, or you could just leave them in there and they'll pyramid up or build a full colony out of them. But the gist of it is that when you did the split, you made sure that the queen was down underneath the queen excluder so you know she's in the mother hive. You have a couple choices here after you do this. You can let them raise their own queen. You can add a queen cell to it, or you could buy a queen and put it in the nuke and they'll be good to go. You should not have any difficulties here because you've cleaned all the bees off and there's no possible way that a queen could have passed through the queen excluder. But as always, if you happen to put a queen in there and she's not treated lovingly, figure out what happened. Somehow maybe a queen got in that box. Highly unlikely, but always maintain that, so if you're putting in a queen that you just paid good money for, you're not throwing it away. In 5 to 7 days, check that the queen is laying, if you put in a queen, or if you are putting in a queen cell, make sure she's hatched out, and follow the math that we gave you a little bit earlier about how long it should take before she gets to work after being mated. So that's it for the fourth method. A couple of quick notes about this. When you're splitting off a hive, you're always a good idea to feed it and make sure that you keep an eye on it. If you put it into a nuke and it's a good nectar flow or you're feeding it heavily, it is highly possible that it will blow up and it could potentially swarm if it gets crowded given what we learned a little bit earlier. Hives should be fed sugar syrup and pollen to aid in any comb that needs to be built out if you put in foundation, and you should make sure that you close off the entrances or provide whatever protection they can, especially if you put them in a large box and they don't have enough bees to defend the whole territory or a large entrance. So going back to the theme of this episode, if you have a hive that is demonstrating that it wants to swarm and you see swarm cups and things like this, it is possible that you will be able to abate the swarm by doing a split and putting in empty resources and taking bees out of the hive. Doing that is almost like the swarm has left and now we need to start over again. It also allows you to split your colonies and become sustainable. And it is a good time of year in the spring when the nectar flow is on to go ahead and do those, and the bees pretty much take care of themselves when they're on a good flow. So those are four methods of splits. Kind of ran through them pretty quickly, pretty summary. If you wanted to follow them again, just listen to the recording a couple times until you get it down or take some notes. If you have any thoughts about how to do splits that we didn't cover, feel free to send us a note, kevin@bkcorner.org, and I'd be happy to hear about methods that you have. There are other methods out there that are, shall I say, more advanced. You could look up the DeMarie method, which we've covered at one point during the podcast. People do sometimes two hive configurations, things like that. So these are very basic, very simple, and not too complicated, and quite frankly, I don't see any reason why you would want to get very complicated in doing splits. Good enough is perfect, is what I always say. So with that, we'll bring this segment to a close. Let's roll into segment number three, the New Jersey Swarm Report. I think I hinted at this in the past when listening to a Michael Bush presentation. He inferred that beekeepers should understand when the local swarm season kicks off in your locale, and that would be very helpful for preparation steps. And it got me to thinking that when does swarming take place in New Jersey? I called a bunch of my friends and made contact with them at some point and said, hey, when does swarming start? Everybody had a different answer, imagine that. So it gave me an idea that maybe what we need to do is start a swarm report. I worked with the New Jersey Beekeepers Association staff to check and see whether any information existed anywhere on the books about swarming in New Jersey, and had a conversation with the state apiarist, Tim Schuler, who said, nope, nothing is out there. So we started a grassroots movement to put a survey up and encourage people to report swarms in New Jersey. As of this writing, we're knocking on 50 reports in just a couple weeks, and we've been able to plot those out in the various locations using a free Google Map type service, and also we've been able to determine what counties they exist in, how big the swarms are, and the other question that we ask about is, what height were they? Standing height, ladder height, or higher than that? It's fascinating to watch the reports come in and people have embraced this, and I'm looking forward to get more word out to folks about the New Jersey Swarm Report. And it's something where we think we could take this through the 2013 beekeeping season, and I believe that when we got started, which was sometime in the middle of April, we hit right on the start because the first couple reports were trickle. And then all of a sudden we started to see a steady trend through the beginning of May. My expectation, if you ask me, was May 1st is when swarm season kicks in here. As you know from what you've been listening to, knowing when swarm season hits in your area is an important thing because swarming starts actually 20 days prior to the actual first swarms kicking off. I thought that the support that we'd get in New Jersey would be sketchy if we don't get the word out. So we're working to post it in the state newsletter. They've sent a message out through the state. We're offering banner ads to put on anybody's website, and we're encouraging Facebook pages and beekeeping clubs to put information out to get the word out about the swarm report. So we believe that through the summer, things will pick up and people will become more aware of this. Ultimately, the goal will be, can we learn anything from the data? Maybe do some pivot tables about where they're occurring, how big they are in general. And then we can also provide this information to the state apiarist, who will promote this data back to the population. And maybe next year we'll do it again and we'll get even better data responses. So very excited about the New Jersey Swarm Report. We base this one over on our Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association page. If you want to go take a look, there's a prominent link on the left-hand side of the navigation when you come in. Been updating at least weekly, if not sooner, what the number of swarm count is. And if you click through the link, you can see the map where people are reporting. One of the things that was interesting is, what kind of data do you ask for? I put in there for people to put the address, and they could literally put street and town and zip code, or they could just say town. I don't make it mandatory. So even if I just know it's Flanders, that's good enough, I believe. Just knowing the size, the date, the time, and the general county information, I think, is going to give us a reasonable view of the data. Then it'll be fascinating next year to look at year on year what the big growths are and how they vary based on weather temperatures. So the New Jersey Swarm Report, it can be found at nwba.njbeekeepers.org. That's our New Jersey, Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association website. That address again, nwba.njbeekeepers.org. Moving on to segment number four, I wanted to talk about queen marking. Never had the opportunity, other than practicing at some state meeting, to actually mark a queen. Bob Kloss and I were at the mentoring hives for Northwest New Jersey and took it upon ourselves to capture a queen and get her marked. Shot a video of that. That's at the YouTube channel for Northwest, youtube.com/NWNJBA. It's a neat experience. Bob had a little tube contraption thing, and I'm going to call him out. He'll laugh at this. He dropped a queen at one point. And if you listen to one of the videos up there, he talks about the klutz gene that he has. It's just one of those things that carries with you, I guess. And I told him I was going to sneak this in here. So, Bob, if you listen to this, this is for you. The International Queen Marking Color Code goes this way. It's, how does it work? It works by year ending. So this is year ending 2013. The color is red. So let me go through it from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 that way. If it's year ending 1 or 6, you paint the bee white or gray. If it's 2 or 7, you paint it yellow. If it's 3 or 8, it's red. If the year ends in 4 or 9, it's green. And if the year ends in 5 or 0, you paint it blue. You'll notice in the video that we painted the queen yellow, because she was a 2012 queen. You could use model car paint. You could buy special paint from a store. Kind of expensive, but it has a little bit of a marker on it. The way you want to put the identifying mark is small, so it doesn't cover any part of the queen other than the back of the thorax. So the way you do this is you lightly dip your stick or your painter in paint, and you gently hold the queen and just put a dot on her thorax. And then you hold her aside for a little while until that paint dries. If you put her back too quickly, they will clean her off, or she could potentially rub it off. Some beekeepers identify queens by clipping the tip of one of the forewings. And I don't know if that's something anybody wants to get into. It's supposed to prevent the queen from flying. That's another thing. But sometimes the bees in the hive think that the queen is damaged and they replace her. So don't know if I recommend that. It can be supplement to the paint technique, but the fact of the matter is, painting the queen is not very complicated, especially if you have one of those tube devices that Bob had. So go check out that video. It's one of the most recent ones posted up there, and you could see us actually marking a queen. It's a pretty neat little thing to watch, and it's a short little clip. We find ourselves near the end of the show. Let's go through rapid-fire succession of roundtable topics. The first one, New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife did a presentation at the winter meeting for the New Jersey Beekeepers Association on bear control. I know just yesterday there was a report of a bear sighting and damaging a hive maybe 3 miles as the crow flies, and Kevin is still procrastinating and has not put his fence up. I am flirting, I can tell, and I just have not had any time to go ahead and get that situated, just like last year. I'm really playing it dangerously, though. If you go to the YouTube channel that I just gave you the address, there's a great presentation given. I believe her name is Michelle Smith, and she did an outstanding job, so go check that out. Roundtable topic number two, weighing in, also on our Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers homepage, nwba.njbeekeepers.org. We're doing a feature where we've been weighing our hives to see where the nectar flow comes. My hive number two jumped 8 pounds last week, so the nectar flow is full on. Bob Kloss is weighing one in, and we're also weighing one of the mentoring hives. Three different yards, three different hives, looking to see what the nectar flow patterns are. They're all in Hunterdon County. Wondering if anybody wants to get in on this, you can tell us a hive in New Jersey or maybe in your neck of the woods, and we'll put some data out there. Roundtable topic number three, taking the tour. The May 25th meeting for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers centers on diseases of the hive. And one of the things we're going to do is have a short meeting in the morning, and then we're going to do something unique for us. We're going to send strike teams out to apiaries of our members. We have a lot of new members who would like to get a hands-on. And we do have our mentoring hives, but it's another thing to bring the show to you. What we intend to do is pair up some of our more seasoned beekeepers and give them a route to go run that day, to stop by different hive locations and go through the hives and see what people have going on. Diseases of the hive is the topic of the morning. We can go in and start getting people situated for the varroa season, which is coming. And one Kevin moment on that. I've been looking through my hives and not seeing a lot of evidence of varroa. Very interesting this year that it seems to be deterred. Maybe the cooler weather has something to do with that? But anyway, we'll be taking the tour May 25th if the weather cooperates. We're starting to get some responses of people who would like to see us. Come join. And hopefully we'll find enough strike team members to put together to go out and make all these visits, or we'll have to schedule a couple rounds of it. Roundtable number four in the news. Can't let this go by. The pesticide ban in the EU. Very fascinating to see what happens there. I know the United States EPA has gone a different direction about approvals for neonicotinoids. But there is now a ban in the EU, and it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out over the next couple years as to whether somebody can glean evidence of neonics are really to blame in the CCD phenomena. Also in the news, bee decline thresholds have been hit. There seems to be a lot of news this year about large losses across the United States. And explicitly, we're starting to hear rumbles of people do not literally have enough bees to go out and do pollination services. I'm reading that they're suffering out in California for the almonds, that they physically can't get enough bees. This day was going to come at some point. I know that a lot of commercial beekeepers, for the love of the business, stay in, but they're losing their shirts, and eventually that's not tolerable. And we have reached a threshold where this is starting to get a lot of press. I'd say in the last 2 weeks, we saw some coverage on pretty much each of our news stations here in local New York and Philadelphia. We get to see both. We're also seeing it be covered in the New York Times, the New York Post, and other areas on the media outlets for the internet that are large. And I have to tell you that at work, I bet I've had a dozen people stop and tell me about this phenomena that the bees are really bad this year. So the word is getting out there. It'll be very interesting. We go through ups and downs of these reports. Not too long ago, Dan Rather did another report. He seems to be one person who just keeps circling back to bring this to the general public. Dan Rather, a local news reporter in New York City, retired. And of course, he's nationally and internationally known and has kept the spotlight on this. And it's good news. I want the scientists and the researchers to keep being able to find the funding to see what they could do to work on the problem, keep the prominence there, and hopefully do something to put these poor commercial guys out of their misery. They must, you know, a lot of people will say maybe they bring it upon themselves, but if you're in that situation, I would not want to walk a mile in their shoes. So in the news lately, beekeeping started to take front and center with the pesticide ban out of EU. A lot of pressure on the United States to see how that's going to go. And the bee decline threshold will keep us in the news probably through the summer. Roundtable topic number five, a mesh bee suit has arrived at my door. I was looking at these last year. I saw them and had an opportunity to get in on a joint order through the beesource.com forum. And I tried it out today and really enjoyed it. There was a light breeze and I could literally feel like I was cooled off and enjoyed, where before, even on a cool day with my brushy mountain suit, or maybe it's a Man Lake suit, it just felt like I was in a sauna. We'll see how that holds out over the summer. If it's hot, it's hot. That's the way it's going to be. But I can tell you that it did really make a difference. And no stings today. Very happy about that. I think I've been stung four times so far this year. We're in the middle of May or approaching. Pretty good. Not too shabby so far. So it's been an hour and something, and I've been rolling a long time to just close this episode down. In the closing comments, I wanted to make a comment that I know I've been away for a while. The typical story of work being very busy, I did take a trip to India for a 10-day run out there to visit some vendor suppliers that I work with from work. Really enjoyed the trip. It makes you appreciate what we have here in the United States. Met a lot of nice people, saw a lot of very neat sights out there. And the funny thing was is, it's summertime where I was in Bangalore, and there were not, didn't see a single bee anywhere, nowhere. I'm shocked. I was in the city, saw lots of flowers, lots of opportunity, but no honeybees whatsoever. On the Friday that I was there, one of my friends who I talk to frequently, he pointed out to me a swarm that was hanging off of an office building. And he said that that swarm had taken location there in the fall and had been there. And you could see they were hanging on this archway that was probably 40 feet up. And there were seven or eight drawn comb pieces sitting there and bees leaving. And those are the only bees I saw the entire time I was in the country. I tried to ask people about buying local honey or going to see something there, and one of the things I was told is that the honey there is poisonous, so they have to treat it in some way, strip it out, strip out the poison so that it actually is consumable. And the funny thing is every morning when I went to breakfast or looked around at different restaurants, there is no honey served in the entire country as far as I could see. I asked so many people about where you could buy honey, or did you have any honey? Do you know anything about bees? And everybody shook their head. They were perplexed. So it was a great trip. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot, and my vendor partners are very accommodating and welcomed me. I am pleased to be happy, pleased to be back in the United States. One of the things I was concerned about is the time frame that I went was when the spring was ramping up for the beekeeper flow, and I'm very happy to say that the hives were doing pretty good when I got back, so allay that fear. And anyway, it's been a busy period for me. It continues to be a busy period. We're working on something innovative at work that has been taking some considerable time, but hopefully will pay off in something very special for our teams there. So I'm not sure how much time I'll spend behind the microphone this summer, but at every chance I like to get in and do what we can here to keep sharing the word of beekeeping with you. So I am rambling. It's late at night. Time to shut this down. I want to thank you for listening. Again, if you have any comments, feel free to shoot us off an email. Visit our Facebook page. I didn't believe I gave that out. It's facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. Been trying periodically to make sure I keep checking in there, and happy to see comments from listeners in there. I typically respond to every email that comes through, so if you have some news to share with me or questions or comments, please feel free, kevin@bkcorner.org. That'll be it for this episode. This is Kevin England, and I want to thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.